the very end of the Sermon on the Mount. The Sermon on the Mount is one of the most kind of complete teaching blocks that we have from Jesus, sharing about what the kingdom of God is all about, sharing what God is like and how we might respond. And at the very end of the Sermon on the Mount, this is Matthew chapter 7, this is how he concludes that sermon. He says, "Everyone who hears these words of mine and does them will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain fell and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, but it did not fall because it had been founded on the rock. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. And the rain fell and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat against the house, and it fell. And great was the fall of it." It's this pure wisdom moment from Jesus. Whatever you're building, you need to make sure that you have a strong foundation, because everything that you build on a foundation will only be as strong as that foundation is. And if you don't build it the way that it's supposed to be, if you don't build it strong and dependable and level, then everything on top of that you build is going to be off. And if your foundation isn't strong, nothing that you build on that foundation is strong. It's just good wisdom, and good wisdom for our lives, and for us to ask the question then, what are we building our lives on? Where do we start? With all the things that we might say are important in our lives, all the things that we're going to do, where do we start with a foundation for our lives? There's a story in Genesis chapter 11, and if you want to turn there, you can follow along. Genesis chapter 11, verse 1, it starts like this. It says, "Now the whole earth had one language and the same words. And as people migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, 'Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly.' And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. And they said, 'Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its tops in the heavens. And let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth.'" We've been looking through a bunch of chapters and passages in the early part of Genesis and looking at some of the foundational things that Scripture says about who people are. And we've been reading, we read about creation, we read about Adam and Eve, and we read about how after that things started to go wrong for a lot of people. And this story in Genesis chapter 11 continues that. It talks about a group of people, and a better translation than the one I just read says that they started migrating to the east. And in the first few chapters of the Bible, moving east is not a good thing. Adam and Eve, after their fall, after they sin, and after they are expelled from the garden, they go out east of the garden, and people start going east. And the more east they go, seemingly they further go from the plan that God has for them, the life that God has for them. And what we're going to see in this story is that it's a repetition of some of the themes that we've already read about. People going further and further into chaos and to disorder and trying to figure out how they're supposed to come back for them. So here's a people who are moving east, and they go to a place called Shinar. That is significant because Shinar, if you look at the history in the ancient Near East, eventually becomes Babylon, and that's going to be an important part of understanding this story as we move along. What the people want in this story, and it's about to go bad, I'll give you a bit of a spoiler on that, but the things that they want as we set up this story are not bad things. Here's what they want from what we just read. They want to build a city, which in the ancient Near East, and maybe even today, it's really important to build a city. It's where people gather. It's where culture is really created. It's where people do incredible things. And for them specifically, it was how you protect people. In a place that was oftentimes very dangerous, a city was somewhere where you could gather people and you could protect your people. And then it says that they wanted to build a name for themselves or a reputation. And who doesn't want a good reputation? Who doesn't want to build a life where people think of you in certain ways and go, oh yeah, this person has certain character or accomplishments that speak to who they are. It's not a bad thing. And then they don't want to be dispersed. Let's build this city in this place where we can gather so that we're not dispersed. And in the ancient world, being dispersed is one of the most threatening thing to a people group, is that if you can't stay together, again, you're going to lose protection. You're going to lose sense of your identity corporately, of your culture and who you are, spread out away from your family, away from your people, and probably in very dangerous circumstances. And so that's what the people want here. They want a city, they want a name, and they want to be great, and they don't want to be dispersed. Now, things are about to go off the rails, and you say, well, what's the problem with all of those things? Why does this become an issue? Which it will in the next few verses. So I want to set that up. What we read here, we've come to understand even relatively recently in biblical scholarship and because of archaeology, what this is all about. You say they're going to build a city and they're going to build a big tower that goes up to the heavens. In the ancient Near East, almost always, you built a city around the idea of a god or a goddess. That was important. Cities were often dedicated to a certain deity, and that was the deity that you worshipped in that place. And so what they would do is somewhere in that city, they would build a temple that was to a certain deity, and then they would build a big tower. They're called ziggurats. You can look that up. Again, archaeologists have dug up a whole bunch of these ziggurats in this part of the world. And essentially what a ziggurat is a big tower or a big, huge staircase. And they would build it right onto the temple. They would build it really high in the air. And the staircase wasn't so much for humans to go up, it was for a god or a goddess to come down. And this was the idea. If we build the right kind of city, and if we build the right kind of temple, and if things look really good, and if we're doing all the wonderful things that we're supposed to be doing, if we build a really great name and reputation for ourselves, if everything is really glorious, and if we build this tower, this ziggurat, that goes all the way into the heavens, then maybe the god or the goddess that we need will come down the staircase into the temple and meet with us and be with us. And maybe if we do all of the right things, if we worship the right way with the right kind of temple and the right kind of staircase and all the right things, then maybe that god or goddess will give us the things that we need and the things that we want. In the ancient world, that's how people really related to gods or goddesses. It was thought that not only do people have needs that the deities could come and serve, but the deities, the gods and goddesses themselves, they had needs that people needed to serve. And that's one of the reasons in the ancient world why the pantheon, the gods, create human beings, actually, is so that human beings can do the grunt work. Human beings can grow the food and offer it to them in sacrifices so that human beings can do the things that they don't want to do. So what we're talking about here when it says that they wanted to build a city and this great tower that goes all the way up to the heavens is there's a people group who are saying, if we could build something so strong, so glorious, so great, and a tower that goes so high up, then maybe there'll be the right god or goddess will look around and take notice of us, that we'll have a great name, we'll be glorious, we'll say, oh, this is where I want to go, and they'll come down the staircase, and we will serve their needs the way that they need us to, and then that god or goddess will give us all the things that we think we need and the things that we want. And so in the ancient world, the way that people related to gods or goddesses was very transactional. Their way of relating to the divine was transactional. If we can build something great, then perhaps God will come down and meet us and we can get what we want. That's what's being set up in this part of the story. Here's these people, and they're going east. They're going the direction that they weren't really supposed to go. They're building something great for themselves, something that can go way up high into the heavens so that the right god or goddess will go, wow, look how great they are. Come down, and they will serve their needs, and that god will serve their needs. It's very transactional. This is what I'll do for you, and this is what I expect you to do for me. So then we come to verse 5. And notice in verse 5 to 9, as we continue to read the stories, that all the things that the people wanted are now going to be undone or taken away from them. It says in verse 5, and the Lord came down to see the city and the tower. Now this is probably, by the way, a little bit ironic, a little bit comical, the way the story is written. They've built this tower so high in the heavens that the gods can see them. But the Lord, the Yahweh, has to come down just to see it. What's that little thing there? It's a little bit insulting. It's supposed to be. The Lord comes down to see the tower, which the children of man had built. And the Lord said, behold, they are one people, and they have all one language. And this is only the beginning of what they will do. And nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. Come, let us go down, and there confuse their language, so that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord dispersed them from over the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city. Therefore, its name was called Babel, because the Lord confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord dispersed them over the face of all the earth. So apparently it was not big enough for God to see from the heavens. He has to come down and see it. And when he comes down, it says that he confused their language. he disperses the people, and the city that they were building, the building stops. So everything that they were doing, let's come, let's build a city. We've got one language so we can cooperate and do this so that we're not dispersed and we can do this great thing. Now God comes down and he does all of the opposite things to break it down. At the end of the story, he calls the place Babel, which is a play on the words, because he says that he confused their language. The word for confuse here in Hebrew is Balel. So Babel sounds like Balel. It's a play on words. This place is going to be called Babel, which is about confusion, which is where we get our name for Babylon, and our word that we say, like we babble, like we say things that don't make any sense. And here, maybe, gives us a clue of what this story is all about, how this story will be interpreted. Because centuries later, down the road, when these kind of stories probably would have been put down in written form and put together in, you know, the book form that we have now in our Bibles, probably was around a time or after a time where the people of Judah, God's people, had been exiled into Babylon, and Babylon had become the superpower of the world, and they could do anything that they wanted, and they were in charge, and they were the enemies of the people of Judah. And one of the ways they read this story back was that this was a satirical look at the history and the beginning of Babylon. To say right from the beginning, you think that you are so great, Babylon. You think you're the world's superpower. You think you can do whatever you want. You think you're great and powerful. And maybe sometimes it looks like that. But right from the beginning, here's the real story. The real story is you're always about pridefully building yourself up and trying to build the highest tower and the greatest temple and the greatest city all for yourselves. But according to this story, it will not last. It never does. Sure, it looks good. You come together, you cooperate, you build this huge, big shrine to whatever God, hoping that you can satisfy their needs so that they'll give you everything you want, but that will not last. And this story survives as a way of God's people saying, our enemies who look like they're in charge, and maybe even looks like they're very successful, they're very good at what they do, but what if you were very successful at all the wrong things and it was never going to last? What if you built on the wrong foundation the entire time? And it's not hard for us to draw some lines between what that says to an ancient people group and what that says to us. What if we became very successful at building all the wrong things? What if we were going about our lives living very transactionally, very much in a performance mindset, very much in I'm trying to build something so great, maybe even so great that other people will take notice and look at my life and say, look at all the things that they have built. Maybe even somewhere deep down that we were building something that we thought was so great that God would take notice of us and say, wow, what a life you've built. All the accomplishments, it looks so good. And maybe somewhere deep in our minds, we think, and if I could build that kind of life, and if it could look a certain way, maybe God would give me everything that I want and everything that I need in my life. It's this idea of a very performative religion, a very transactional religion that grabs so many of us. This idea that I need to build up myself. I need to build up my life. It needs to look really good, but if I can get to that point, if I could be successful, then maybe God will give me all the things I need and all the things that I want. It becomes very foundational to us. That kind of performative religion is fueled by a number of things. I will point out three to you, and I think they're in this story. But more than that, I think they are lived out by many of us. And even if you're not trying to do those kinds of things, even if you're not trying to build a life that glorifies yourself, that says, I'm going to build up my own thing for me, that these things seep into our lives. Performative religion is fueled, number one, by fear. I'm so scared, and so I need to do something about this. For these people, they were scared of being dispersed. And by the way, the things that they want, reminder, they're not bad things. Just like the things that many of us want are not bad things, or the kind of life that we would want to build up are not bad things. But when we are fueled by fear, we know that that's going to be a real problem. These people were scared of being dispersed, scared probably of the threats that are coming around them from other people that would attack them, and that was a real deal. We need to make sure that we build something strong to protect ourselves. It's not a bad thing. Second thing, insecurity. In insecurity, we always have the idea that we need to do more. We need to do more. We need to do more. It's the idea that I'm not enough right now. And if I'm going to be really secure, I've got to build something more. I've got to build something flashy. I've got to build something tall. I've got to build that tower. I've got to make sure that I'm always moving forward and getting bigger. The third thing is fueled by striving or working for it. It depends on me. It depends on my effort. It depends on what I can build. Notice that is in the first half of the story we read, the people. It's we're going to build this. We're going to build this city. We're going to build this tower. We're going to create a name that is great for us. We're going to perform. And if we perform really well, and if this tower gets tall enough into the heavens, then the gods will come down and we'll finally have everything that we need. I would suggest that that way of living will be exhausting for us. If those are your motivations, if those are the primary emotions that you feel that really fuel who you are and your identity, that will be a foundation upon you at which you will continue to build, and you'll get tired. And oftentimes you'll feel like a failure. And even if you succeed, you will probably come to a place where you get everything that you want, and maybe you'll realize that you were really successful at building all the wrong things. It becomes almost cliche for us to talk that way. Now let me show you a flip side of that, or a comparison to that. That story is there for a very real reason at the end of chapter 11. In the book of Genesis, there's a big flip in the story that starts in chapter 12. In the first 11 chapters of Genesis, we've got some very big general stories that are talking very much about humanity in general. In chapter 12, the story shifts, everything shifts down to one man and his family, and it starts with Abram. And in the first few verses of chapter 12 in Genesis, we have a very stark comparison or contrast to the story we just read at the end of chapter 11. You're going to hear a lot of the same words, a lot of the same themes, but you're going to notice a very key difference. Let me read it for you. Genesis chapter 12 says, "Now the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. And I will make you a great nation. And I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. And in all the families of the earth shall you be blessed." Notice a couple of things. I'm going to give you a land. By the way, a place where they're going to go, Abram's descendants are going to go and build a city, a great city, where they're all going to gather and they're all going to be together. "I will make you a great nation or people group." And he says, "I will make your name great." You've heard all of these things before, just a few minutes ago. What's the difference? What's the difference? Here's a group of people. We want a city. We want to be together. We want to be kind of a people group or a nation. We want to have a great name. We're going to build this great thing. God comes to Abram and he says, "I'm sending you over here. You come with me and I'm going to make you a great nation and I'm going to make your name great." And you say, it sounds very similar, but what's the difference? Notice here, this is not Abram's initiative. I'm going to do all these things. I'm going to build all these things. It's God's initiative. "I will make you a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless you." And here is the foundation. What's the foundational difference under all of that? This is not a foundation that's rooted in fear or insecurity or striving. It's not a life built around performance, but it is a life that flows from promise. Yahweh says, "I have great things in mind for you, Abram. I have a great plan for your life. It's not always going to be flashy. It's probably not always going to look like a huge tower that everybody's super impressed with, but it's going to be very adventurous. It's going to be very dangerous, and it is going to be spectacular. Come, and I will make you a great nation. Come, come away from everything that you've known, what makes you comfortable, your family and your place, because I have something even better for you." And this is the foundation of the promise to Abraham. This is the foundation that is strong that you can build off. This is the foundation that that other group of people simply didn't have. The life of faith is built on blessing. God's blessing and God's promise to Abraham. This is the foundational difference. Not Abram, this is what you're going to do to build up your life and make it look great and make a great reputation for yourself. No, I am going to bless you and I'm going to make your name great and I'm going to give you the place where you can gather and I'm going to give you all the things that you will need. But the life of faith is built on blessing. And what is true for Abraham and is true for you and I New Testament, one of the things it made clear is that the children of faith, or the children of Abraham, are the children of faith. That Abraham becomes the father of a great nation of the people of Israel. And when Jesus steps onto the scene, a lot of them just claim biological lineage. Hey, we're literally in the line of Abraham, and that's what makes us God's people. And Jesus comes and says, hold on for a second. You can't just claim that you are Abraham's children and not live the way that Abraham lived. His true children in the New Testament, this is borne out in a number of places. The true children of Abraham, the true children of God are the people of faith that live out of their blessing, just as their ancestor, their forefather Abraham and his family did. A life of faith, the life of faith is built on blessing. And it's true for us. So how do we live out of our blessing? How do we build a foundation on the promises that God has given us on his blessing? I will suggest three things this morning. Number one, a life of blessing is received. We see this in the story of Abram. He doesn't decide that he's going to build something great for himself. Instead, he receives the promise blessing of God. And that for Abram becomes an invitation to be part of what God is doing. Not on his own initiative, not just the kind of life that he thinks that he should have, but for God to say, I've got a massively amazing grand plan for you. If you would like to be part of it, I invite you into it to be blessed and to live that out. It starts with God's initiative and understanding who God's called us to be. This is actually spectacular because we don't read that much about Abraham other than that he's called. First, his name is Abram. God changes it to Abraham as the story goes. But it's interesting. We see the same paradigm in the life of Jesus. Jesus did incredible things. If you read the gospel, Jesus performed miracles. He healed people. He fed people. His teaching gathered all sorts of groups of people that would come along, and they were just dying to hear what he had to say. He brought people back from the dead. He did spectacular things. But before he did anything, before we read that he did any of those things, before anybody was following him, before he did anything miraculous, we read about this from Matthew chapter 3. It says, and when Jesus was baptized, so Jesus goes out and he has John the Baptist baptize him. It says, immediately he went up from the water, and behold, the heavens were opened to him. And he saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove and coming to rest on him. And behold, a voice from heaven said, this is my beloved Son with whom I am well pleased. Isn't that just such a beautiful thing? Not because he could do miracles, not because he could heal people or feed people or even bring people back from the dead, not because he was an amazing teacher, not because he had built a reputation, not because people were following him around, but because one day he went out and he was baptized, and when he come up out of the water, he hears his heavenly Father say, this is my beloved Son with whom I am well pleased, in whom I delight, who brings me joy. This is the life that Jesus lives. This is the foundation that Jesus builds his life on before he does anything. This is who he commits to be, receiving the blessing of his Father. Could you imagine what it would be like if every day you and I lived out and received that blessing? A couple of weeks ago, a friend of mine here at the church told me that every morning he gets up and he meditates a few moments on this verse to hear this verse spoken to him. And imagine, because today, this, I believe, is a call to you and to I to hear that same voice to you, to hear God, who loves you more than you could ever imagine, say to you, this is my beloved daughter. You are my beloved daughter. You're my beloved son. And I am so delighted in you. You bring me joy. Before you do anything, before you build anything, before you have a name for yourself, to be given the name Beloved, Blessed. To say, I'll live the rest of my day out of that basic foundational truth about my identity. Perhaps more than anything else that I say today, that'll be the application. To wake up every day and take just a few moments and to meditate on this verse and to hear God saying this to you, his beloved children. Number two, a blessing is to be given away. So much of our performative lives keeps us in fear and insecurity and keeps us holding things for ourselves. It's part of the problem of that city, that Tower of Babel, is that they were there to simply make a name that was great for themselves and great for their people and our city and our tower and all the things that we want. You'll see that Abraham was called to a whole different life, called to be blessed, but in order to be blessed, to be part of God's great plan that wasn't just for him and just for his own family, but that his family would grow and grow and grow and then would be a blessing to the entire world, to everybody. That is the great blessing. By the way, this is how God works. If you want to enter into all the good things that God has for your life, you're going to need to be generous for them. We read about that kind of cyclical way of being in all sorts of facets, and Jesus teaches this, of God's character. It's the same thing with forgiveness. You can't really experience forgiveness for yourself if you're not willing to give it to somebody else. It would be entirely hypocritical. If you realize you've been forgiven for all the things you've ever done and all the things that you haven't done that you shouldn't have done, there's no way to not offer that to someone else. That's how forgiveness works. That's how grace works. Grace is being given something that you don't deserve. And if you're given a life that you don't deserve and all the things in life that you don't deserve, there's no way to withhold that from someone else because you didn't earn it. You didn't build it. You didn't make your own great name. You received blessing from God. And so now a blessing has to be given back. In Hebrews chapter 11, it says of Abraham, by faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to a place that he was to receive an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going, but by faith he went out to live in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, living in tents with Isaac and Jacob, heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city that has foundations, whose designer and builder was God. He didn't foresee a city that he could just build for himself. He foresaw that part of the blessing was going on an adventure to be part of building a city that God was building, a blessing that would be for the entire world, for all people, and he got to be part of it. Summarize these two points, I would say blessing is kind of like this. You can't give what you don't have, and you can't have what you won't give. You can't give what you don't have. It has to start by receiving. We can't give people something deep within us if it's not within us. We can't give people the blessing of God. We can't give people grace. We can't give people forgiveness. We can't really truly love people until we've received that for ourselves. And these things are gifts from God, not that we earn, but that we receive. You can't give away what you don't have. And so we need to start by receiving that identity that we're giving as God's blessed and beloved children. And then you can't have what you won't give. If you think that God is kind of this cosmic genie and it's a transaction that if I've done something, he'll forgive me, he'll give me grace, he'll give me love, and it stops at you, well, you can't have that because it doesn't make any sense. The grace, the forgiveness, the love that God gives us must be given. And so if you want to have those things, you must be willing to give those things. They are cyclical by their very nature. And so a life of blessing is received. We start by receiving it, by hearing God call us his children in whom he delights. A life of blessing must be given away. A blessing is only a blessing if we're willing to be open-handed with it and give it back to God by giving it to other people. And then thirdly, a blessing is more about who you are than what you do. And I'm nervous to say this because what you do is very important. I actually don't want to tell you that it doesn't really matter what you do. It matters who you are. It actually very deeply matters what you do. God cares about your actions. He cares about your morality. He cares about the decisions that you make. He cares about how you treat people. Jesus very clearly told us, come and follow me. Do what I do. Love like I love. Treat people the way that I treat people. What we do is very important, but it needs to start with who we are. It needs to start on an identity level so that we're living out of the person that we are, not trying to pretend to be something that we're not. That's why we have to start by receiving God's blessing, by receiving him calling us his beloved children, and then living out of that. This is what a lot of our spiritual practices or disciplines help us to do, to remind us of who we are, to hear the voice of God, to build a strong foundation so that the natural outflow is blessing. Blessing in, blessing out. Built on blessing, deep down foundationally, then we live that blessing out to other people. So what you do is very important. It just needs to be an outflow of your authentic self, and that authentic self needs to be built on blessing. That's why the life of faith is built on blessing. It's not built out of a place of fear or insecurity or striving that says, I'm not enough. I'm never good enough. God's disappointed in me. Other people are disappointed in me. If I just work harder, if I build a bigger tower, if I build a bigger city, maybe I'll get their attention. None of that will work. We need to start by living out of God's blessing. I started by telling you that Jesus, at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, he said, those who do what I've just told you to do, you live out my words, are like people building on a strong foundation. And you can build on a rock so that when hard times come and life gets difficult, the rains come down and the waves start running, you can stand. Or you can be like someone who doesn't live that way, and he's just warning them, if you don't live in this wisdom, it's like building your foundation on a sand. If you don't build a strong foundation, then when the waves come and when the rain falls, then your structure's going to fall apart. You need to have a strong structure, he's saying. And in the Sermon on the Mount, what goes before that is, Jesus has told us, told the people following him, to do some of the most difficult things you could ever imagine, to the point where a lot of people who interpret the Sermon on the Mount say, Jesus couldn't have been serious. He could only have been talking about one day in heaven, this is how we're going to live, because it's just impossible to live up to those standards. And part of that is true. We live out of grace. We have to live out of grace. But Jesus was very serious about saying, come follow me. Do these things. Here's what you should do with your anger. Here's what you should do with your lust. Here's how you should love your enemies, not only your neighbor. These things that we go, this eludes me. This is so hard. How could I possibly do that? How could I build on that foundation? So Jesus says at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, which maybe is why this is how he starts the Sermon on the Mount. Before he tells them to do anything, before he lays out all the ideals of the kingdom of God and how you're supposed to live, here's how he starts. We often call them the Beatitudes. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God or daughters of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. These things, and I don't have time to go through them, but pretty much everything on this list, especially in that culture, are counterintuitive. They're not things that those people would have aspired to. They would have aspired to strength and power and wealth. I mean, so many of the things that we still all aspire to. Jesus, at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, says, build your life on these words that I've given you. Do the things I've told you to do, and you'll be like someone strong building a foundation on the rock. But before he tells them all the things that they're supposed to do and the ways that they're supposed to act and even the positions of their heart, he comes to the people that nobody would have said, you're blessed. It's all counterintuitive. Nobody comes to someone who's mourning and says, oh, you're blessed. No one comes to the people who are persecuted and saying, oh, right now you're blessed. Do you know why? I mean, we look at our circumstances. When people have money, when people are healthy, when people are doing well, when their family is going really good, we go, wow, what a blessing. And those things are all a blessing. But maybe this is exactly why Jesus starts where he starts, because nobody tells these people, you're blessed too. This is who you are. This is what you live out of. When you're mourning, you're blessed. When you're bankrupt in your spirit, you feel like you've got nothing left inside of you and no strength and no resources, Jesus comes and says, congratulations, you're blessed. When you're meek instead of being the winner, Jesus says, congratulations, you'll inherit the earth. You say, but I won't win the battle. I'm not going to win the war. I can't beat all my enemies. That's how they would get land. Jesus says, no, I'll give it to you as an inheritance. I mean, go down the list, all of these things. You're persecuted. People don't go to persecuted people and say, you're blessed. People don't go to people who are reviled and people who are being spoken evil against and lied about. But Jesus says, maybe this is exactly when you need to hear this message. You are blessed. Because in all those places, in all those situations, whatever your circumstances look like, God will come and meet you. God has a plan for you. You are blessed. You are his beloved. And just like Abraham, he says, come follow me. I have great things in mind for you. But I'm not building a city like everybody else is building a city. I'm building a city that's a blessing to the whole world. In Jesus' words, I'm building a kingdom. You want to come be part of it? You say, I'm kind of a loser. No, you're blessed. And God wants to meet you right where you are. So today, before we leave today, maybe your circumstances aren't great. Maybe you haven't won anything recently. Maybe you feel like you're on the outs. Maybe you feel like a failure. Maybe you feel like you can't build much of a city or much of a tower and nobody is going to take much notice of you. Maybe circumstances are going really poor. Maybe you're going through something really difficult. I would say, to build a strong foundation. The life of faith is built on blessing. And God wants you to know today that you are blessed. He wants to speak all of his goodness into your life right where you are, to meet you there, even if it's in pain at the moment, and to call you to live out that blessing, to receive it, and to be able to give it. And so hear these words, a blessing that is thousands of years old, that comes from Numbers chapter 6, to you today, the beloved children of God. May the Lord bless you. May he give you every good thing and all the resources that you need in your life. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May he protect you from the threats that come against you, from the things that today seem overwhelming, from the things that you can't see past at the moment. May the Lord make his face to shine upon you. May you see God's face light up when he looks at you like a grandparent looks at their granddaughter or their grandson. May you hear God's voice calling you his beloved today. May he be gracious to you in giving you things that you don't deserve and a life that is more than you could ever earn. May the Lord lift up his countenance upon you. May he look you straight in the eyes and give you all of his attention as someone who loves deeply does. And may he give you what only he can deeply give you, his peace, his shalom, his goodness, his blessing. And may you today live out of the blessing and build your life on that foundation.